From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an innocent victim of the War on Terror and the secret policy that led to his deportation and imprisonment. In 2002, Maher Arar was on his way home to Canada by way of JFK Airport. During the layover, Arar was detained by American authorities who suspected him of having ties to terrorists. He was deported to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and imprisoned in a tomb-like cell. After his release, a Canadian commission cleared Arar of all terrorism allegations and apologized for Canada's role in his deportation. We'll talk with Arar and his U.S. lawyer, Maria LaHood, and journalist Jane Mayer, author of the bestseller The Dark Side, will explain how Arar's case fits into the secret American policy of extraordinary rendition. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story you're about to hear is considered by many people to be a classic example of a grave mistake in the war on terror. On September 26, 2002, my guest Meher Arar was detained at JFK Airport while in transit on his way home to Canada from vacationing in Tunisia. At JFK, he was interrogated about alleged links to terrorists. 12 days later, he was deported by U.S. authorities to Syria, where he was put in a tomb-like cell, beaten and interrogated. Arar was born in Syria and moved to Canada with his family at age 17. He's held dual citizenship since 1991. He was returned from Syria to Canada in October 2003, and the Canadian government eventually opened an inquiry into his case. In 2006, a Canadian commission cleared Arar of all terrorism allegations. He received an apology from the Prime Minister for the Canadian government's role in his apprehension and was awarded over $10 million in damages. Arar's deportation by American authorities was part of the secret program known as Extraordinary Rendition. Before we meet Arar, we're going to talk about rendition with Jane Mayer, a reporter for The New Yorker. She writes about extraordinary rendition and Arar's case in her bestseller about the war on terror, The Dark Side. Jane Mayer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me start by just asking you to explain extraordinary rendition.
Well, extraordinary rendition is a tool that's been used in the war on terror. It's a means of basically kidnapping someone against whom there are outstanding legal charges and rendering them to justice. At least that was the old-fashioned version of what it was. In the Reagan years, the idea was to pick up suspects against whom there were already sort of major rap sheets for crimes already committed. And what happened in post-9/11 periods was that instead suspects started being picked up who were just seemed to be sort of suspicious characters, but not necessarily against whom there were real rap sheets or kind of criminal records. And it was part of the preventive model that the Bush administration had put in place, where they wanted to be able to pick up suspicious characters before they committed crimes.
Why was Meher Arar's name on the terror watch list in the first place?
Well, he had the misfortune of placing on a rental lease for an apartment he rented in Canada the name of a man who was the brother of a terror suspect. And later, when the suspect himself and another man were being questioned brutally and in a very coercive kind of way about any possible other terrorists they knew, these suspects were asked specifically about Arar because of the name on the lease. And at that point, these suspects gave false confessions implicating him, saying, oh, sure, he's a terrorist too.
So how did the Immigration and Naturalization Service determine that Meher Arar should actually be deported and sent to Syria for interrogation?
Well, you know, much of this still remains mysterious because the public officials in the United States have not answered all the questions here. Unlike Canada, they have not had a major internal investigation to try to get to the bottom of it. In fact, they have pushed away all efforts to investigate this. So much is unknown, but you can see that there were rendition papers, they described it actually as an immigration action, signed by the number two at the Justice Department, Larry Thompson, who authorized that Arar should be picked up and sent to Syria. Arar had dual citizenship at the time. He was both a citizen of Canada and a citizen of Syria, which was where he had been born. But he hadn't been in Syria since he'd been a teenager, and his family was in Canada. And Arar protested immediately that he didn't want to go back to Syria. Everything he'd ever heard about it from his parents was that the law enforcement process there was unjust and brutal, and he didn't want to be subjected to torture immediately. That's what he thought of. And so he protested, but they didn't listen to him.
The United States doesn't exactly have a relationship of cooperation with Syria. In fact, shortly before Meher Arar's rendition, President Bush added Syria to the list of outlaw states that he describes as the axis of evil. So how did the United States work out this cooperative relationship with Syria in which the U.S. would send somebody like Meher Arar for interrogation and Syria would cooperate and report back the results?
Well, it's an amazing situation because obviously we don't regard Syria as a close ally in any way. What actually happened was they sent the U.S. flew Arar in a very sleek Gulfstream jet, not directly to Syria, but first to Jordan, which worked very closely with the United States in the war on terror. And then Jordan was commanded by the U.S. to hand him over to Syria. So there was a kind of a cutout in the process. But in the war on terror, all kinds of convenient alliances crop up. I mean, the United States has worked with many brutal regimes, such as Uzbekistan and Syria, too.
How was Meher Arar finally released from Syria after months of interrogation?
Well, his wife just took up the issue and wouldn't let it drop. And so she continually protested inside Canada and pushed and pushed and finally got enough of a kind of a protest going that the ambassador then had to check in on him. And at first, Arar was too frightened to tell about how brutally he'd been treated. But anyway, eventually, Canada realized what a mistake this had been, and they finally worked to let him out. I mean, the Syrians, who are not known for coddling terrorists, after interrogating Arar under really brutal circumstances, came to the conclusion he was not a terrorist and that this was a mistake.
So if his wife hadn't worked that hard, or if Meher Arar wasn't married, who knows if he'd still be alive or where he would be?
Very much so. I think, I think that he might still be wasting away there.
Canada has apologized to Meher Arar and awarded him over $10 million in damages. What's his status in the United States legal system now?
It's quite amazing. He is still considered by the United States to be worthy of being on the terror watch list. The reasons for this have not been shared with the public, so I don't know exactly why. At some point, the Justice Department had a private meeting with some members of the Senate to try to convince them that Arar belonged there. And those senators said they still were unconvinced that he should be on the terror watch list. But this means he can't set foot in the United States without being arrested.
Do we know if the Extraordinary Rendition Program is still going on?
Well, it's still very much on the books. I mean, the Bush administration describes it as one of its most useful tools, and they've certainly never apologized for it, and they've continued to argue that it's legal. The sticky spot legally for the program, though, is that under the Convention Against Torture, the United States is not allowed to transfer someone to a country where they will be, where there's a greater than not chance that they'll be tortured. So yet, under the Extraordinary Rendition Program, suspect after suspect, hundreds of them apparently, have been transferred to countries where torture is routine. And so it's very hard to see how they've gotten around the Convention Against Torture in structuring this program.
You write about Meher Arar's story of extraordinary rendition in your book, The Dark Side. What do you consider to be the importance of his case and his story?
Well, one of the most important things is that in the view of Canada and in the view of Syria, two countries that probably agree on very little, they agree that Arar is not a terrorist. He was a mistake. He was an innocent person who, because of this extra legal process, which took place outside of the public view and outside of checks and balances and all the kinds of reviews that are usually put in place to avoid mistakes, an innocent man was locked up in the equivalent of a grave for almost a year and beaten, and might still be there if not for the protests of his wife. So it's just a harrowing story.
Jane Meher, thank you very much for talking with us again.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be with you.
Jane Meher is the author of the bestseller The Dark Side and a reporter for The New Yorker. We'll talk with Meher Arar about his deportation and imprisonment in Syria after a break. This is Fresh Air. When we left off, Journalist Jane Mayer was explaining the secret American policy of extraordinary rendition, which allows for terrorism suspects to be deported to countries where they are imprisoned, interrogated, and in some cases tortured. And she told us the story of my guest, Maher Arar. He's a citizen of Canada and Syria who was deported by American authorities to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and kept in a tomb-like cell for over 10 months. Arar was released in October 2003 and returned to Canada. 3 years later, a Canadian commission cleared him of all terrorism allegations. Arar is a wireless engineer who is now studying for his doctorate. Meher, let's start with your story. You were at JFK Airport on your way from Tunis to Canada, and this was just an airport stopover. You'd been vacationing with your family. How were you told that you were being detained?
Well, I presented my passport at immigration. To my surprise, I had to go through immigration. It was just transit, and I had traveled extensively before to the States, and none of this really happened. They asked me to go into a waiting area, and eventually some airport police and New York police and FBI people showed up, and they asked me whether I was willing to give them an interview. And I found that very puzzling, as they did not really tell me ahead of time what it was about. And my immediate reaction was to be able to make a phone call, to call my family. And I also asked them to be able to have a lawyer present. And they told me that I had no right to a lawyer because I was not an American citizen. And that was a shock to me.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
Well, as usual, the questions started, with the routine questions. But eventually, they asked me about people I knew in Ottawa. We now know that those people were having some suspicions about some of these people as a result of a Canadian investigation. But from the nature of the questioning and the information they had, in fact, they had a thick report in their hands that they were consulting from time to time. The nature of the questioning and the information they had made it clear to me that they had private information that could only come from Canada.
Jane Mayer in The Dark Side writes that although you didn't know it at the time, you were falsely implicated when two men were tortured in Syria and under torture just offered up your name.
Today, we have a lot more information than we had before on the public record. And so we kind of know more about the story. But at that time, you have to remember, I was in the dark about what was going on. And do we really know the full story yet? I don't think so. I think there's so many other pieces of the puzzle that we still have to find. But you're quite right. Apparently, those two people they were asking me about, at that time they were both detained by the Syrian military intelligence. Apparently, as a result of information sent from both the Americans and the Canadian police, and under torture, one of them had confessed to a false plot against the U.S. embassy in Ottawa. But it does not seem that he implicated me in whether directly or indirectly in that plot. But the Syrian military intelligence, who was at that time trying to prove to the West and especially United States that they were doing their fair share of the war on terror, they actually had to just find something on so that they could please the Americans. So they had to ask, about other people, and eventually, according to the public information we have, he confessed to have seen me in Afghanistan, and I don't think I was alone. He probably named many other people. So maybe that was in the hands of the Americans where they were asking me. We really don't know all the facts. But the O'Connor inquiry clearly stated...
This is the Canadian inquiry into your case.
The Canadian inquiry, it's about what it took about 2.5 years of public investigation. I just want to clarify this because it's an important point. the commissioner of the inquiry clearly stated in his report that my problems all started with the Canadian police, which we call here the RCMP, which is the equivalent of the FBI. They sent false information to their counterparts, and that led to all my problems. Now, whether the Americans had information from Syria or not, we don't know the facts, but obviously the commissioner concluded that I was sent to Syria very likely based on this false information sent by the RCMP to the FBI. And just to give you an example of what this kind of information was, one report described myself and my wife as Islamic extremists with possible links to Al-Qaeda. And during the inquiry, the RCMP officers admitted that they had no evidence whatsoever to use those labels. So, and they never corrected their record with the Americans. So I just want to be, you know, give a clear picture about what kind of information the FBI had in their possession before I was stopped there.
Meher, you were held for 13 days in the United States. Then you were put on a plane. You were told you were being taken to Syria. What went through your mind when you heard that you were being taken to Syria?
First of all, I was shocked that a country like the United States, that always prided itself with protecting human rights and condemning torture, and that they would send me to there despite my fears, despite the fears I expressed to them that I would be tortured. That was my initial reaction. And then when I realized I was actually going to go there, I did not want to believe I was being sent to Syria because of all the memories I had from my childhood when my parents told me about how people are tortured there, especially political detainees and people accused of being members of Islamic groups. And then when I was on the plane, all the time I was very worried about what was going to happen next. Basically, I became convinced by that time that the Americans sent me there to be tortured. There was no other explanation for me. So during the entire trip, I was preoccupied about how I could avoid torture. That was my main, worry. Once I'm in Syria, how I avoid to be tortured.
So when you got to Syria, you were taken to a prison that's apparently very notorious, that's nicknamed the Grave. And Jane Mayer describes it as the heart of the Syrian intelligence service's dungeon-like interrogation center. What was your cell like in this Syrian prison?
My cell was about 3 feet wide, about 6 feet deep, and about 7 feet high. Frankly, when they opened the door for me and they asked me to go in, I naively thought that I would be put in there for a day or two just to put pressure on me. But that cell ended up being my home for the next 10 months and 10 days. This cell, as filthy as it was, as dark as it was, as small as it was a refuge for me from physical torture. But over time, the cell in itself became a torture, psychological torture on its own. Just to give you an idea about how desperate I was to get out of that cell, I was ready to confess to anything. If they just, take me out of that place. It was so horrible. And that's why I've always called it the Grave, because it's really like a grave. You're put in there. It's dark. You don't know anything about the outside world. It's so small. It's filthy. At moments, I really say to myself, life is not worth anything anymore. And, I lost hope. And it took 10 months and 10 days before I was taken out from that cell. I was in very, very bad shape.
The only times, I guess, you were taken out was to be tortured. So when... go ahead.
The main interrogation really, you know, happened during the first, I would say, 10 days to 2 weeks. That's where the physical torture took place. Eventually, they took me upstairs a couple of months later to ask me one or two or three questions. But really, the main interrogation and the harshest sessions were at the beginning. That's where they used the physical torture.
What did they want to know?
Well, it was so obvious that the Syrians wanted to know more information about, you know, my life in Canada, my life in the States. Remember that I spent a year and a half or about almost 2 years working for a Boston firm. And so obviously their main questions centered about my life, you know, my travels, the people I knew, what kind of work I was doing, you know. But I could tell after a two-week period, they never told it to me directly, but I could see in the eyes of the Syrian interrogators that I, you know, I was not the person that I was described to them by the Americans. You have to remember, the Americans dumped me in Syria or in Jordan, then eventually I was taken to Syria, accusing me of being a member of Al-Qaeda. And so the Syrians had to do the dirty work and beat me. And, you know, even though you confess to false things, the Syrians know it's false. And at the end of the day, what they're looking for is information, sound information. And I think really after, you know, 2 week period, they convinced themselves that there was nothing there.
Meher Rar will be back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Nasiri, presenting the Love Sees No Color CD and bonus DVD in stores and online September 16th at nasiri.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the voting process for all Americans at pewtrusts.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Meher Arar tells us about the false confessions he made under torture. And we'll hear from his attorney, Maria LaHood. She's filed a federal lawsuit alleging that the Attorney General, the Director of the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security violated Arar's rights under U.S. and international law. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Meher Arar. He was a victim of the secret American program known as Extraordinary Rendition. This allows for terrorism suspects to be deported to countries where they can be imprisoned, interrogated, and tortured. Arar was on a stopover at JFK on his way home to Canada when he was detained by American authorities and later deported to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and imprisoned. After his return to Canada, a Canadian commission cleared him of all allegations of terrorism. Torture or extreme interrogation techniques have become so controversial in the United States, and everybody has been asking, well, do they work? You know, do these techniques actually get usable information? Give us your experience of that. Tell us a little bit about what was done in terms of torturing you and what that got you to say.
Well, I think human beings have this, any human being has this tendency to be able to resist to pressure, but frankly, any human being, as strong as he is or she is, they will just give up at the end. And that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to resist the beatings, but the Syrians eventually, after the first day and then of interrogation, they realized I had nothing. And the next day, they wanted me to say that I had been to Afghanistan. After many sessions of beatings and being left in a room to hear other people being tortured, I told them what they wanted to hear.
But you told them you were in Afghanistan, that you'd been in
Afghanistan?
That's
right, that's right.
Did you tell them, they wanted to hear that you were a member of Al-Qaeda, did you tell them that?
I don't remember being asked about directly that question. You know, you have to remember that what I'm telling you is only a portion of what I remember. Believe me, you go in those sessions, it's like survival mode. You just want to, you know, survive. Do you remember every question they asked you? Do you remember every accusation they told you during that session? No. And I only remember bits and pieces from some of those sessions. You know, the most striking thing that I remember was about Afghanistan, because that's where they focused and the most extreme beating happened, you know.
Could you give us an idea of what went on in your mind and the kind of bargains you made with yourself about how far you'd be capable of holding out before just telling them whatever they wanted to hear?
Well, you resist, but you see, the first day they didn't accuse me of anything. They were just gathering information. The beating happened next day. The head of the interrogation team opens the door. I was just, you know, in that room alone, without mention, uttering a word. He asked me to stand up and to open my right palm, and he hits me with a cable, and you know, it's very hard to describe that feeling, that pain. But to give you an idea about how extreme this pain was, I've always used this proverb in Arabic that basically says the pain that results out of the beatings is beyond imagination, to the point that where you will forget the milk that you have been fed from your mother. So basically, it's so intense to the point where you just beg them to stop. And obviously, at the beginning, you know, you say, I'm not going to say what they want to hear. But eventually, you're ready to do anything. You know, whatever they put in front of you, you'll just sign it.
Okay, so you comply with them finally. You tell lies just in the hopes that the torture will stop, and in the hopes that they'll send you home. So you tell them what they want to hear, and then what? Does the torture stop? Do they send you home?
Well, in my case, the torture did not completely stop, but it became a lot less intense. So if I remember correctly, from that moment on, they did not use the cable with me, or if they did, it was occasional. They mostly beat me with their fists, punched me, slapped me on the face, and beat me on the back of my neck. They also played mind games with me by taking me into a room blindfolded against the wall, and a lot of people would be talking about me, and you know, out of nowhere, someone would jump and beat me on the back of my head. So I would say after that, it became less intense. They wanted to know my relationships with other people they were interested in, and and what I did for a living and all of that. But after that false confession, the beatings became less severe.
Did you feel that you told them anything that could be used against people who you knew? Do you think anything you told them could be misconstrued and be used against family or friends, colleagues?
I don't remember, and I don't think so. But again, see, they're not like normal sessions where the FBI is sitting around the table and asking questions and maybe recording this and allowing your lawyer to record what you say and what you don't say. There are sessions where beating is the norm and fear is the norm. What do you say or you don't say, and what they write or did, it's not. But I can tell you, I don't think I have said things that would implicate people in anything. But basically, I could tell that, like, they were looking for something that the Americans did not find. I mean, that was a strong feeling in me. I mean, I could tell in their eyes, in their, like... And once that false confession took place, they were extremely happy with it. And, you know... so they just wanted to prove that they're better interrogators, maybe, than the Americans.
So after you'd be in an interrogation session and beaten and badly wounded by that, then you'd be put into this tomb-like... underground cell that was basically like a little bigger than your body. How do you recover from wounds like that in a filthy tomb-like cell?
Well, let me tell you something that it's very hard for people, and you have to remember there are people who were tortured more than I was. And believe me, sometimes when I heard their stories later at a different prison they sent me to, I mean, I couldn't believe they were still living, you know. I think faith played a big role in this. You know, I'm a believer, and believing God helps you go through tough times. And now, actually, if you ask me how I survived those days, I can't tell you. I really don't know. Again, as I say, the human beings have this ability to adapt, and does not mean it was easy for me, but the pain, some of the pain, I could tell you, lasted for about 6 months. And up until today, I think back and I say, my God, how I was able to survive all of this.
What about mentally? How do you mentally survive in a tomb-like cell?
Yeah,
the mental
pain, I could tell you, was the most severe, because you see, the physical pain, even though some of the pain lasted for a while, but you know, it's intense at 1 day or 2 days, 3 days, and eventually get the pain to go away within a month or two or three or four. But I could tell you that the mental pain and the psychological pain live with me until this day, and that I've been struggling with it and for since I came back. It was at its peak during that 10-month period, and believe me, at the end I couldn't take it anymore. I'll just give you an example. Being locked up in this cell on itself, it's a type of torture, but also being incommunicado, like, you don't know what's happening to your family, to your kids. You start thinking all kind of things, you know. Are they also doing well? Have they been kidnapped like you? What are my kids doing? How are they doing? Are they eating well? What is my wife doing? You know, that alone is... And remember, you're being put in there... 24 hours a day, except the few minutes they take you out to the bathroom. I mean, that alone is mentally demanding, and that's why I call this time a slow death process. Basically, you're basically dying. You know, at the beginning, I was able, you know, to do some push-ups so that I could keep in a good physical health, but after a few months, you know, I started with 20 push-ups, then 10 push-ups, then 5 push-ups, then eventually I wasn't able to do any push-ups at all, and I don't know if they kept me more in that cell, I would probably be dead by now.
My guest is Meher Arar. We'll talk more about his case, and we'll hear from his U.S. lawyer, Maria LaHood, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Meher Arar. He was accused by American authorities of having connections to terrorists as part of the secret American policy of extraordinary rendition. He was deported to Syria, where he was beaten, interrogated, and imprisoned. So you're kept incommunicado in this cell. You don't know what's happened to your family. How did your family and the outside world find out where you were?
My wife and my family started making some phone calls with the Canadian authorities, and they did not know anything about me until a few days later. They knew I was detained in the States. They didn't know what it was about. And it took about a week before I was allowed to make a 1 minute or 2 minute phone call to my mother-in-law to tell her that I was at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. That was the first time where they had a confirmation where I was. But basically, for a few days, my wife and my family did not know about whether I was dead, whether I was alive. They knew nothing. And
did they know when you were taken to Syria?
No, it was a surprise to everyone. No one knew about it.
So how did they find out that you were in a cell in Syria?
It took about a few days until the Canadian authorities found out, and they informed my wife about it. Where in Syria, in what condition, how, no one knew. There were some rumors, too, that I was sent to Jordan, which is a fact, but people were told that I was kept in Jordan for 2 weeks, and yet I only stayed about 10 hours in Jordan.
Jordan was just a stopover on the way to Syria.
It was a stopover.
Let me introduce your lawyer into the conversation. Maria LaHood, welcome. And Maria LaHood is from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Maria, Meher Arar is still not allowed in the United States. How is that affecting your ability to represent him?
Well, it makes it difficult. I mean, it also makes it difficult because we, you know, we expect probably that our communications are being surveilled. You know, he can't come here for his hearing. He was at least able to listen in by phone to the prior two hearings. But, you know, I need to go up to Canada in order to meet with him.
There's two separate cases that have been pressed. One is there's a minimum of two. Anyways, there's been a two-track system, one in Canada, where Meher Arar is a citizen, and one in the United States, where he's not a citizen, but it was the United States that had the extraordinary rendition program and sent him to Syria for interrogation. So tell us the outcome of the Canadian case.
Well, after the 2.5-year public inquiry that Canada launched, which exonerated Meher and found that Canada had given the United States false and inflammatory information, had not acted fast enough in securing his release from Syria, and had, you know, had false leaks against him after his return, Canada settled Meher's Canadian lawsuit.
And Canada awarded him, was it $10.2 million in compensatory damages, and offered an official apology for what happened?
Yes.
And so take it from here with the American case now.
So the American case, which was brought in January 2004, shortly after Meher was released, was brought against, you know, then Attorney General Ashcroft, the Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, the FBI Director Robert Mueller, the INS Commissioner James Ziegler, and then other immigration officials. And, you know, the case was brought basically because the U.S. government officials violated Maher's constitutional rights in sending him to Syria to be tortured and arbitrarily detained, and in preventing him from, you know, accessing his counsel in the courts while he was in the United States. So the district judge in New York dismissed his case in 2006, essentially for foreign relations and national security reasons.
I think the court said that the case would pose too much of a threat to national security to be heard in court.
Right, right. So, you know, I won't find whether there's a constitutional violation. I won't permit it to be adjudicated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and recently in June got a 2-1 decision. And the majority decided partially along similar grounds, saying the same thing, which is that, you know, we won't adjudicate the case because of foreign relations and national security reasons. The other thing that the court did was say that because Congress had provided foreign citizens with the ability to ask a court to review their removal order, the court here wasn't going to provide a remedy to Maher, even though, you know, what he alleges is that the officials prevented him from going into court in order to stop his transfer to Syria. And as far as the denial of access to counsel in the courts, the majority decided that Maher, as a foreign citizen who hadn't formally been admitted into the United States, had no constitutional right or any other right to access his own counsel and to have his own counsel present. And the majority found that because, you know, even though Maher had alleged, you know, repeatedly that he said he would be tortured if sent to Syria, and he had alleged that sending him to Syria violated the Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty that the United States has ratified, and which, you know, specifically prohibits sending someone to a country where there are substantial grounds that they'll be tortured, that it wasn't clear from his complaint that what he would have done had he gotten into court is claim that he couldn't be sent there because of the Convention Against Torture prohibition.
So where does the case stand now in the United States?
So we had, you know, after the appellate court came out with its 2-1 decision, with I should say, a very strong dissent by Judge Sack, who acknowledged that what the majority was saying was essentially giving license to U.S. federal officials to violate the Constitution with virtual impunity. We were going to ask the full Second Circuit, you know, not just three judges, but the full 12 or 13 judges to reconsider Maher's case. So the day before we were planning to do that, we found out that on its own, the full court, the Second Circuit en banc, had decided to rehear Maher's case without even being asked. So, which is quite an extraordinary move. And, you know, we think shows the importance of the case and the importance of the issues. So right now we'll be rebriefing the issues before the full Second Circuit, and there'll be a rehearing on December 9th.
What are you asking for? What do you hope to achieve from the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there are many levels. I mean, you know, one is justice for Maher and what was done to him. We want to hold the U.S. officials accountable, those who actually were responsible for sending him to Syria to be tortured and arbitrarily detained. We hope to, you know, really establish that this country does respect the rule of law, does respect human rights, that the Constitution and the law mean something. You know, what the courts have done so far in this case is really defer to the executive completely. And that's, you know, our Constitution is based on separation of powers and the ability of the judiciary to review what the executive does. And here, that hasn't been upheld at all. You know, the court needs to make clear that we are not a country who tortures, that we are a country who enforces the rule of law, and the executive branch is not above that.
When we speak about human rights, we don't say Muslim human rights or American human rights or Christian human rights. It's just human rights. And we can't have, you know, many standards that apply to different people. We have to separate the actual crime from the actual, rights. Every human being, no matter what kind of suspicions we have about them, no matter what kind of crimes they have committed, they should be afforded rights. And that's why the Constitution exists. It exists to protect people from abuses by the government. And unfortunately, this is not the policy that this current administration has been following. And I really believe it's backfiring. It's not doing any good to whether the American people themselves or whether to their allies.
My guests are Meher Arar and his American lawyer, Maria LaHood, from the Center for Constitutional Rights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking with Meher Arar about how in 2002, American authorities accused him of ties to terrorists and deported him to Syria, where he was imprisoned, beaten, and interrogated. Meher, you are now studying for your doctorate in wireless engineering at the University of Ottawa. The Canadian government has apologized to you. It has awarded you over $10 million in compensatory damages. So in Canada, like, your name has been cleared. Nevertheless, do some people still think, oh, maybe he really was a terrorist? Do you feel like there's still suspicion around you that you'll never be able to fully clear?
Well, I think even if I clear my name in the States, there will always be those people who will say, well, there's smoke, there's fire. And I can do nothing to those people. What I know is there has been an inquiry in Canada, a full-blown inquiry, that clearly told the public that I'm in no way a threat to Canadian security. But I just have to do what I have to do. I have to keep up the struggle to be able to fight my name. And, you know, I'm doing this for my kids so that when they grow up, they're proud of their father. And I have already achieved the first part of my objective here in Canada, and there remains the second part in the States.
Where do you feel you are now in terms of your physical and psychological recovery from your imprisonment and torture in Syria?
My physical scars have you know, faded away, except a little bit my hip, you know. But to my surprise, the psychological ones, some of them have faded quite a bit, but some others are still with me on a daily basis. Basically, I'm not able to function as the same person that I was. For those who know me from before, they know someone who was, you know, if I tell you overconfident, I won't be overstating that. Someone who's got energy, someone who's got, you know, ambitions about his career. Now, you know, I'm a different person. I'm very fragile. I'm, you know, I have this fear always of traveling. I always, you know, worry of the unknown. And so just if you take the confidence part alone is very, make me so dysfunctional, because in my field of study, in my field of profession, you really have to be extremely confident in what you do. And I also want you to know that this cloud that, you know, that keeps hanging above me, whether we like it or not, you know, even I was cleared, people still keep calling me sometimes in the media, former terror suspect and all those names. that reminds people about what kind of allegation there was, and that alone is a form of torture, basically. And it's with me on a daily basis. The bright side, though, is you know, a lot of people shake my hand and support me. And but am I able to live the same life that I lived before? Just to give you one example about what I mean is, if before I applied for a job, let's say I put my resume on Monster.com, and I would probably get, especially in my field of study, it's very specialized, it's in big demand. I would probably get 5 or 6 phone calls within a week. Now, if I put it up, even with my PhD, with my all qualifications, rarely I think that I'll get a call from anyone. In fact, just recently, I tried to find a job again with my US-based employer, at least doing some work remotely or in Europe or here and there. But unfortunately, there was no interest at all.
Well, Meher Arar, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate it a lot. And Maria LaHood, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Meher Arar's U.S. lawsuit goes before the full Second Court of Appeals in December. His lawyer, Maria LaHood, is with the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. From Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from MasterCard. World MasterCard is designed to give you access to a world of possibilities. Learn more at priceless.com/world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mike Myers. His film, The Love Guru, just came out on DVD. Also out on DVD this week is season 1 of the ABC series Pushing Daisies. We'll hear from two people behind the show, creator Brian Fuller and director Barry Sonnenfeld. Join us for the next Fresh Air.